during the summer we like to do topics. Parker refers to it as turning Kirby loose. So that's why we have this one today on media and the digital world. And I thought this would be very applicable to the world that we live in, and at the same time get a chance to spend a little bit of time thinking about some of these contemporary issues. So really what I want to do is encourage you to maybe learn a little bit more about this. And as we go through this, think about the impact that media is having on your children and on your grandchildren. For that matter, look at the impact that's having on you. And if you say, well, I can't wait to get a book, or I'm probably not going to read a book, but I might read a chapter, you can go to our website, probe.org. Almost everything I'm going to quote today, if you do a search, you'll be able to find some of those facts and figures. Ready with me? So what we're going to do for just a few minutes is talk about how do we take kind of biblical principles and apply them to this area of media and especially this digital world. And the first thing I want to do is talk about just the issue of choice. We live in this world of overchoice, as best illustrated by the fact that if you go into a grocery store, there's 125 different kinds of yogurt right now. If you look for coffee, 551 different kinds of coffee. If you, for example, have a satellite dish and pull down satellites, 1,500 different movies offered every single month, and you have to make choices. I know I have some Starbucks fans here. If you take all the different kinds of cups of Starbucks, all the different flavors, all the different options, there are 19,000 ways to order a cup of Starbucks coffee. Is that just sort of overwhelming to you? Which is why if you're in line behind somebody who doesn't know what they're going to do, it can take a really long time. And, you know, if you look at all the cars, all the colors, all the options, 25 million versions of cars. Well, I use that apart from media to talk about what is happening in media, especially to the younger generation. They are faced with levels of choice that are unprecedented in the history of the world. These next statistics come from a very good book, which are entitled Screens and Teens. Now, if you have a teenager, or you have somebody in your household that's going to be a teenager someday, you want to get this book by Kathy Cook. But she reminds us of the tremendous media overchoice that's affecting young people today. For example, YouTube users upload 72 hours of new video every minute. Email users, 204 million messages every minute. Google receives over 2 million search queries every minute. Facebook, 684,000 pieces of content. Twitter, 100,000 tweets every single minute. Apple receives 47 app downloads every minute. Organizations, 34,000 likes. Instagram, 3,600 photos. 571 new websites. WordPress, users published 347 new blog posts. And this is the problem even before we get into the issue of the media, and that is the issue of overchoice. Here's something you learn from sociology. That is, as choice increases, commitment decreases. The more choices you have, oftentimes the less committed you are to those choices. And so this is a real concern as I have spent more and more time writing about and doing broadcast on the subject of millennials, is that they are faced with this massive overchoice, but sometimes brand loyalty, commitment are decreasing. So even before we talk about what's in the media, we should be concerned about what this might be doing to the level of commitment. An example I used up there at Word of Life this week is most of them live in a community where there's really only one Bible teaching church. If you go back to the Barna research, you find that within the locality of where Word of Life is in Scroon Lake, there are seven of the most pagan cities in America surrounding them, like Schenectady and others, where there just aren't that many people that go to church. Matter of fact, fewer people go to church by percentage in Vermont than any other state in the Union. So they see a situation where if you have just really one Bible-teaching church, that's the only choice you have. But I said, if you go to communities where you have maybe half a dozen Bible-teaching churches, have you noticed people kind of church shop over time? They leave the church for sometimes very trivial reasons. Well, if you see that happening in the church, that's happening worldwide, and it's happening nationwide in part, I think, because as choice increases, commitment decreases. Let's get more into the subject of the media for just a minute. Some of you have been in the class before, you've seen this, but I know we have a number of people new in the class that have not seen this. And one of the individuals I enjoy interviewing on a pretty regular basis on Point of View is George Barna. George Barna, a number of years ago, wrote this article in Christianity Today in which he was really trying to understand the sources of significant influence. What are the things that really direct our society and are moving our culture? And he concluded that the sources of significant influence were movies, television, the internet, books, and music, along with public policy and law and family. Now, what do those first five have in common? They're all about the media. And so it illustrates only so significantly how profound media is influencing us, but especially our children and our grandchildren. Now, when he published this in Christianity Today, it generated more letters to the editor than any other article that had ever been published, because it was quite controversial because of this. He concluded, based upon his survey, that the church is not even in the top 12 sources of influence. Now think about that for just a minute. You know, if you go back 100 years and you were to do that survey, what do you think would be the greatest sources of influence? Church and family. Today, family is much further down the list and church is not even in the top 12 sources of influence. I used to use an illustration when the numbers worked out. They don't work out quite now. But it used to be that we had 300,000 churches and we had 3,000 movie theaters. Which one has the greater influence? I mean, the churches outnumber them 100-1. Now, the ratios are off a little bit now. But still, you could see how he came to that conclusion. Well, for just a minute, if you have young people in your sphere of influence, I mean, some of them, they're your children, your grandchildren. And some of you, they're individuals you minister to or people that you work with. Let's talk about the use of media, and this comes from the work that was done by the Kaiser Family Foundation. Now, these are just numbers on a chart. So what I did was I created this graph to visually illustrate as they, over time, have every about 5 years done interviews with those who are 8 to 18. And the first is we'll look at television in the blue. And when we look at television, we see that over time, the number of hours or minutes, at this case, young people watch television is increasing every year. Then we look at music. That's in the red here. And we see that's increased rather dramatically. And I think the next time they publish their results, and I'm waiting for them to come out, that will have expanded in large part because even when these surveys were done, we did not have the complete market penetration of the iPod or the iPhone. But young people listen to lots of music today on their earbuds, right? We look at computers. We see that has jumped precipitously. And again, that's not just due to laptop computers, but it's due to what? Everybody on their smartphone has a computer. And video games. Matter of fact, one thing that came out recently by Lifeway, which is the research arm of the Southern Baptist Convention in Nashville, they concluded if there's one form of media that so identifies with the millennial generation, it is what? Video games. And we can see that video games have increased rather dramatically over time. At this point, you say, has anything decreased? Well, yes, reading has decreased. And then movies. And so you see, if you look at the 2009 number, which is now a little bit dated, but we'll get to the newer ones and sometime soon, is you have about 10 hours of media consumed in about 8 hours. So wait a minute, how do you consume 10 hours of media in 8 hours? It's called multitasking. Are you familiar with this? The TV's on, the computer's up, they're texting on their phone, and they're supposedly doing their homework. Are you with me on this one? Right, of course. And so you can see that this is a concern. Just if you, if nothing else, take away from this particular talk the need for us to have greater discernment, to maybe decrease screen time. Wouldn't that be a good thing? Now, again, if you think that we're against media, look at the fact that I'm in the media, okay? Media is very important. If you think Parker and I are going to encourage us to take all of our electronic devices out here and have a bonfire, that's not going to happen. If you know Parker, you know that's not going to happen, okay? Right, okay, you got that. And really, let's also be honest about how technology has advanced the gospel. Many of you in this room became Christians because of Billy Graham. Well, even if you came forward at a Billy Graham crusade, many more people came to know the Lord because of Billy Graham being on TV. We have friends here today. They're with the Jesus film. Just think of how the Jesus film has been used to expose so many individuals to the gospel. I mean, I even realized that they estimate that on our radio program, in a cumulative week, 1.44 million people listen to the program, which is still hard for me to believe until I go to Word of Life and I got people from Maine saying, I listen to you every day. People from Ohio, I listen to you every day. You know, you don't hear that here, although we're just about ready, I think, to get a new radio station here in Dallas. That's another kind of fun thing that's going to happen. But still, I talk to more people every week on radio than I'll ever meet face-to-face in a lifetime. So God has certainly used technology. We're not down on technology, but I think we really need to reevaluate how much media exposure some of us have, and especially young children have. And let's look at that for just a minute. By the time an average person in America graduates from high school, he or she will have seen 22,000 hours of television. They will have only been in a classroom about 11,000 hours. So look at just the sheer force of media in the lives of young people. Now, most of you probably don't have your TV on 7 hours a day, but the average American television is on 7 hours a day. I don't know how that number comes up there other than if you've been doing church visitation here through Evangelism Explosion. You know, when you go into some of these homes, the TV's just always going on. It's just like this electronic fireplace, always kind of glowing in the dark over there. But still, 22,000 hours of television. Now, if you think about that, when you talk about just TV alone, that's only kind of the sheer numbers. That's kind of the quantity of media input. What about the quality of that media input? The average American teenager, by the time he or she graduates, will have seen 16,000 televised homicides. That is a level of visual violence which, again, is unprecedented in the history of the world. They will have seen 200,000 acts of violence, hitting, slapping, kicking, things like that. And one more, we'll give you lots of more statistics. They will have seen 640,000 television commercials, which I think illustrates the power of that. If you do a youth rally, and we used to do this all the time, where we would play jingles from commercials, or we'd ask them to maybe sing along. Now you can do this with a Katy Perry song or a Lady Gaga song. They'll be able to sing the lyrics and everything. And you put up a Bible verse and have everybody repeat the Bible verse. Crickets, you know, quiet. You know, it just illustrates again how profound the media is in our lives. So the question I've got is, well, how do we think about this biblically? Because when I look at my Bible, I don't see words like iPod or DVD or anything like that. But I think we have some biblical principles. Let's look at a few of those. In my book, Christian Ethics in Plain Language, I have a lot of verses, but let me just use three in the interest of time. When Paul writes to Timothy, probably one of his last letters, and he's sending Timothy into a very pagan world, this Hellenistic Greek world that we've been talking about the last couple of weeks in 2 Corinthians, what does he say? Flee from youthful lusts. But as soon as he says what not to do, what does he say? Then pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace. So that would tell me that certainly I need to pay attention to this secular world. And our world, I would suggest to you, in the 21st century is more like the first century that Paul sent Timothy to than any culture we've ever seen before. Let's look at another one, Colossians 3:8. Here we see that Paul, once again, as he's writing to Colossae, he has already talked about in Colossians 2:8 to not be taken captive by false teaching. And now he begins to help them understand how to not be taken captive, not to be culturally captive, by saying, but now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these, anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Now, would that mean that I could not read something that has anger in it? Well, no, the Bible has anger in it. That's not the issue. The issue is that a wise and discerning Christian would pay attention to what's coming in my eye gate, in my ear gate. One of the things I learned when we did computer programming, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out, right? Put too much garbage in, the garbage comes out, right? And so again, if the wrong things are coming out, maybe I should be paying attention to what's coming in. One last passage, which would be certainly relevant, is the need for us to focus on those things which are positive. In Philippians 4:8, to focus on those things which are true and noble and right and pure and lovely and admirable and excellent and praiseworthy. And really to feast our minds on those things. And the goal here is biblical discernment. Does it mean that I should not go on internet websites? No, I'm going to point you to some internet websites. I already have. Am I saying I can't watch television? No, but I think really in this digital world, we're going to have to think about the impact that's having not only on our lives, but the lives of those around us. In my book, Christian Ethics in Plain Language, I talk a little bit about the need for us to evaluate the impact that media is having. And three major points, and again, you can read more about this later if you'd like. And that is, the first thing is we have to understand that the media, oftentimes, is presenting an unreal view of the world. It's just one that isn't corresponding to reality. Here's a newsflash. Reality TV is not reality, right? Okay, you get that one. Most importantly, it presents an oversimplified view of the world. One-dimensional characters, predictable plots. But perhaps the greatest concern, and that is this. The media oftentimes desensitizes its viewers. The level of visual violence, sex, violence, pornography, profanity, over time, it wears us down. And so I think we should begin to reevaluate the impact that this very useful form of technology that God has given us can have in a detrimental way. Had somebody come up afterwards and say, well, what about these kids that watch all these videos? And I said, you know, my line on that one is, VeggieTales is great, but 17 times in a row is not great. You know, there is even good things can be bad and done in excess. Some are asking, well, what about Minecraft? What about war? What about all these violent video games? Well, again, the fact that you ask the question tells me that you already know that there's possibly a concern. But let's look at just even television for a minute. More homes have TV sets than have indoor plumbing, so obviously lots of homes have TV sets. But when we look at this, a lot of people say, well, I can watch it and it has no impact on the way I think. Oh, yeah? People that have been doing research for a long time come to a very different conclusion. Let me just pick one. This one is a very popular one. You can find it in the Psychology Today and various popular literature. But it was done at the Annenberg School of Communication, University of Pennsylvania. And it's the scary world of the TV heavy viewer. They found that heavy TV viewers tended to vastly overestimate their likelihood of being involved in a violent crime. Why? Because they see so much violence on television that they think the world is much scarier than it really was. We had one student we met at the University of Texas at Dallas from China. And after a couple of weeks, he said something in a meeting that just floored us. He said, I don't hear any gunfire. Because his perception of the streets of America were conditioned in large part by some of the action movies that he had seen. And he expected to hear every once in a while. If all you knew of America is what you saw on Hollywood movies, you might have a biased view of the world, wouldn't you? They found that heavy TV viewers also tended to overestimate the percentage of people in white-collar occupations. Doctors, lawyers, businessmen. Why? Because a lot of those programs deal with individuals in those professions. And most importantly, they found also that heavy TV viewers tended to vastly overestimate the percentage of Americans compared to the rest of the world. Why? Because those programs deal with Americans. Now, the point I'm making is not that it's absolutely essential that you understand the percentage of Americans compared to the rest of the world. But the point I'm making is, if those things which I can measure quantitatively are skewed, would it make sense that other things that are difficult to quantify, sexuality, materialism, narcissism, those would be skewed as well? I think I can prove with this and many other studies that what you see, read, and hear does affect your worldview. Does it affect your behavior? Let me give you a couple of illustrations of that. Again, using television. The American Academy of Pediatrics have published a number of articles in their journal Pediatrics. And one of those was a study that came out many years ago showing that young people, especially teenagers who watch lots of sexual images on television, are more likely to get involved subsequently in sexual behavior. They also found, when they even did follow-up studies with young girls, teenage girls that watched lots of sexual images, had a higher percentage of teen pregnancy. Now again, correlation doesn't prove causation, but I think you can see that you see lots of sexual images, you can see how that would lower inhibitions and cause the possibility of getting involved sexually. What about violence? Well, this comes from their study, which was a meta-study of about 1,000 different studies, including 3 major studies from 3 different surgeon generals from 3 different administrations that all concluded that there was a causal connection between media and aggressive behavior in some children. So again, does it affect the way you think? Possibly. Does it affect the way you believe? Certainly. So how do we react? I think as Christians, we need to make sure that when we're watching something, we're listening to something, we're reading something, we're evaluating what is the worldview. So what is the worldview? Well, we can look at a couple of worldviews. First of all, a worldview of naturalism. Upper left-hand corner there, Richard Dawkins, the God delusion. Lower left-hand corner, when he was alive, Christopher Hitchens, God is not good. Peter Singer, Bill Maher. Again, does that mean we can't watch those programs or read those books? No, but it means that we should have what? Discernment while we do so. Let's take another one. Pantheism. Who's that character in the upper left-hand corner there? Yoda, you know? Again, the idea of pantheism. Shirley MacLaine, Deepak Chopra, the Dalai Lama. You have all sorts of books and movies and other things emphasizing the occult, Gnosticism, the Da Vinci Code, Twilight, Harry Potter and others. And also, a whole issue of sensuality. Now, to be real careful to pick images that wouldn't turn you into a pillar of salt when you saw them up there, but just again, just think of the role models that young people have today and the need for us to, again, exercise some discernment. But in the interest of time, let me get into a second issue, which has really surfaced and why I've put a fair amount of this in this new book, Arts, Media, and Culture. And that is, we recognize that now, especially with these digital devices, it is quite possible that it's beginning to affect our brains in the way we think and the way we perceive things. And the way to illustrate this is go to a very famous science fiction movie, which many of you probably saw, 2001. You might remember the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, in which HAL, the computer, kind of goes crazy. And so Dave Bowman eventually has to disconnect the computer. And as he's disconnecting it, HAL, the computer, says, Dave, my mind is going. I can feel it. I can feel it. And that's used as an illustration by a man by the name of Nicholas Carr in his book, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. Because I can feel it too, he says. He says, over the past few years, I've had this uncomfortable sense that someone or something has been tinkering with my brain, remapping the neural circuitry, reprogramming the memory. He talks about the fact that, you know, he'd pick up a book, he'd begin reading, he'd read a whole chapter and look up, and it'd been a half an hour, an hour, and he just wondered where the time went. Now when he reads, he finds his mind wandering sometimes by the second paragraph. And he says, something's happened with the issue of using computers. It's changed the way I read. It's starting to change the way I think. And this is why he's put together this book, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. Now, the issue is what we call neuroplasticity. If you want to actually impress your friends, drop in the conversation, neuroplasticity. That is, the brain is a lot more plastic than we thought it was. And that sometimes can be a good thing. For example, we recognize that one of the principles about our brains is use it or lose it. This research here found that right-handed violinists, that part of their brain was much larger. If you were to look at my brain and you were to look at the brain of my sister-in-law who plays the violin in the symphony, that part of her brain has grown larger simply because of all the fingering she does as a violinist. So use it. And it increases dramatically. Not use it, and eventually those connections disappear. And so by learning the violin and by practicing every single day, it increases those neural connections. Here's another one. Studies done of cadavers of London taxi drivers found that the hippocampus, which is the part of your brain which really understands spatial dimensions, was much more developed in taxi drivers who had been driving taxis for decades compared to taxi drivers that have not. And again, that would make sense because they really, in a sense, in their brain have a three-dimensional map of London. Now, the obvious implication is if you're going to get a taxi driver who's been driving for a long time compared to one that hasn't, or get a taxi driver rather than an Uber driver. Maybe, I don't know. But the point I'm making is you can see that in many cases, the brain develops in ways we are just now discovering, and that's a good thing. Well, it also can rewire itself, and that can be a good thing. Individuals that have had a stroke sometimes can teach one part of their brain to actually develop the various technologies and the various neural connections that were lost. And, of course, we just heard today from Roger Williams. His aide was shot. You can imagine that. But think of one member of Congress, member of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. She was shot in the head. They've been using various technologies and treatments to have one part of her brain take over responsibilities that was lost when that part of the brain. So, again, the rewiring can be positive, but it also has a negative connotation, doesn't it? Because now the Internet, as this particular article points out, is rewiring your brain. There's some obvious implications. One of those is addiction. Tremendous addiction, which we'll get to in just a minute. Another is distraction. Have you ever tried to carry on a conversation with somebody with their cell phone in their hand? You know what I'm talking about? Ever been in a meeting where somebody tends to be looking at their cell phone the whole time during the meeting? You know what I'm talking about? It's called distraction. They have found that just even having the cell phone on the table decreases a person's attention to your conversation. Have you been there with me on that? Certainly. How about depression? I go on Facebook and everybody's having such a great time and I'm not. I'm depressed, right? And so we're seeing that the digital world is leaving people depressed about what they aren't being able to experience. What about overload? I just talked about that. Too many choices, overload, and I don't have any sense of taking meaning or making any kind of meaningful connections. Let me come back just to one of those issues in the interest of time. Then I'm going to let Parker grab a microphone, and if you want to ask a question, we'll try to do that. But let's talk about media addiction for just a minute. I mentioned George Barna a number of years ago in his article, Media Addiction. I read it and I thought, yeah, everything's an addiction. I'm tired of hearing about everything's an addiction. But as I read through it, I thought, he's really convinced me. Because if you look at the signs of addiction from the American Psychiatric Association, young people oftentimes show media addiction. Those of you that heard me speak on this before have heard the fact that one of my colleagues at Probe Ministries has been a professor at UTD. And he teaches a class in technology. And one of the requirements in that technology class is for you to go through a 48-hour digital fast. Now, how do they do that? The students are to give up their cell phone to Dr. Terlizzese. Would it not surprise you that a number of the students will take a zero on the assignment because they cannot possibly part from their phone for 2 days? Those that do give it up, they come in after 2 days sweating and in withdrawal symptoms because they can't imagine what it was like to live without their cell phone. Now, don't laugh. I know some of you maybe took off to work one day without your cell phone. You go, how am I going to get through my day without my cell phone? Ever had that happen? Okay, preaching to the choir. But he also points out something else. Parents constantly complain about the fact that their kids are oftentimes exposed to inappropriate content, but he points out that the parents are the enablers. Think about this. If you don't like the video game your child has, who drove him or her to the store to get the video game? If you are sad that they went and saw a movie, until the age of 16, they probably couldn't drive to the movie theater. Are you with me on this? And if you say, well, they're too addicted to their cell phone, they probably didn't have the money to buy the cell phone themselves. So it's back to, I know this is a concept, parents might need to be parents once again. And so those are just a couple of obvious application points. But I want to leave some time for your questions, but let me just mention that this whole point of view series, a biblical point of view on government, biblical point of view on economics, biblical point of view dealing with technology and social trends and arts, media, and culture, just a few of those. And we've got those books here today for any of the visitors or a few of you that would like to know a little bit more. But let's, if we can, just see if you've got some comments or questions that you might want to ask. So who would like to be the first person? I know we don't do this very often, but I gave us a minute or two. I think we've got some right back there. So I saw that first hand go up. So let's see if we can deal with that. Yeah. It would be helpful for probably everybody to take the microphone.
I know you pointed out things that spoke of saturation levels, but what sort of information is out there that says this is a safe level of exposure? Or is there information out there that shows what safe levels of exposure are?
And again, I'm not trying to meddle in your life and let you make your own decisions, but there are more and more people who could not sign the doctrinal statement of Prestonwood Baptist Church at the American Association of Pediatrics. They're saying a child under 5 should not have a cell phone. You know, I think that's pretty obvious, right? So there's some limitations right there. There, interestingly enough, are some people that work in the high-tech industries that don't even let their kids have a cell phone until they're in their teen years. So if people that work in media don't do this, it's like, you know, we've heard some of these movie producers that don't let their own kids see their own movies. You know, what do they know that we don't know? So that's the first issue. But you're back to saturation. Let me take television as a good example. They found that the heavy TV viewer was a person who watched 4 or more hours of television every day. So they found that a heavy TV viewer actually had their worldview changed. You might say, well, I don't watch 4 hours of TV. Half of America fits into that category. So obviously, if you want to at least perceive the world more accurately, it would mean that maybe I don't turn the TV on at 6 o'clock and have it run all the way to the Tonight Show ends. See what I'm saying? Or, you know, start the day by television. So right off the bat, you can see some of that as well. But I think a lot of it comes from just your own particular experience. If you begin, remember I gave you Colossians 3:8, you begin to see some things manifesting. You're saying, you know, I'm not thinking right, or I don't really have a biblical worldview, or I'm spending more time with my cell phone than I am with God's word. Okay, there's a couple of indications of maybe where you could begin to draw the line. But I think the biggest issue is even more so, most of us as adults lived in a pre-digital world. So we live in a world where we can kind of evaluate that. If we're talking about our children and grandchildren, many of them have never lived in anything but the digital world. So we're going to have to give them some direction and some guidance in that regard. Wasn't necessarily specific numbers, but those are a couple of principles I would use to evaluate whether or not you're oversaturated. Make sense? Any other questions? Okay, back here. Thank you, Parker, for manning the microphone today.
Of course, my wife's grandfather said when he stands up, his thoughts sit down, so I haven't a clue what I was going to ask. No. So I read recently that our youth are leaving the church by the scores, and then I saw something the other day that the founder of Facebook, I don't know his name, said that he can provide church on Facebook to the masses. Yes. Would you comment?
Yes, and Pastor Graham, as you heard Jarrett mention today, Pastor Graham's going to do a message on will the church be replaced by Facebook? And I love what Jarrett said. No, for a couple reasons. Facebook will never be the church. Number one, because it doesn't have the Holy Spirit. Number two, because it's not the bride of Christ. But it is this idea that maybe we can create community. The sad reality is that even if you have Facebook friends, they're not like face-to-face friends, are they? So, I mean, I think, first of all, there is this the naive idea that maybe we can use Facebook to replace the church. First of all, the church has been around a long time before Facebook ever existed. And if Facebook ever ceased to exist, the church would still be there. So that's the first issue. But there is this sense of people wanting to have community. And that's why I think the millennial generation is saying, where can I find community? Well, again, community is not being found in the secular institutions of America. You're not going to find community in politics right now. You think you already heard that. You're not going to find community in your local park or communities because people aren't going there anymore. Where it used to be, we grew up and we all met together in the baseball field. There were times when I would say goodbye to my mother at breakfast and she would not see me till dinner. Didn't sometimes even know what zip code I was in. I know right now, if you have children or grandchildren, if 5 minutes you've lost track of one of your children or grandchildren, you're at like DEFCON 3, aren't you? So there's no community there anymore because everybody's sort of in their homes. So this is a hope that we'll create virtual community, which I think is a joke. But nevertheless, I'm looking forward to Pastor Graham's message because he's going to be talking about, is the church going to be replaced by Facebook? I'll give you spoiler alert. The answer is no, not even a chance. And more importantly, these virtual relationships are not even real relationships, are they? What the gathering together, which it talks about in the book of Hebrews, is so that we have face-to-face connections, accountability, vulnerability, and all the rest. And everybody puts their best foot forward out there on YouTube and Facebook and things like that. So just not going to happen. Any others? I guess we're getting close there. So Parker, let me turn it back to him, but hope you learned a little bit about media. Next, okay, we got one more here. Next week we'll be talking about 2 Corinthians 11. Get back into this. Yes.
Since you have maybe acknowledged that technology, and we kind of all know that it can be an addiction, like rehab clinics for alcohol and drugs, do you know of any clinics that are presently being started or in existence for addictions to technology?
Yes, the answer real quickly is yes. I believe there's even one here. I sit on a board with an individual that's a psychiatrist, and they've talked about these digital addiction clinics because individuals manifest itself in a number of ways. First of all, we saw this with the young people a long time ago, these gamers that will play for 36 hours. And then sometimes just fall over dead, you know, because they've been drinking Red Bull and things like that. So we've seen this problem of digital addiction existing even before the advent of the digital devices. Now we're going to see more and more of those. And it's the same kind of addiction. If there's one thing we've learned, addiction is where you get this feedback mechanism. You get these endorphins. You know what happens when your cell phone buzzes. Ooh, I wonder what that is, you know. It's just a little bit like a hit of adrenaline, of endorphin, just like you get when you're playing a slot machine or when you're watching pornography or you're drinking or whatever. And so this digital addiction is something which, again, needs to have some kind of intervention in some extreme cases. In one way or another, let's all admit that every once in a while we do get addicted. That's why I think we need to have wise and discerning Christian perspectives on what we do. Parker?